In Kalidasa's play Vikramurvashi, we find in the second act an interesting passage where Urvashi uses her divine power to create a love letter which is found by the king and his Vidushaka. The king's love is confirmed. He is excited and, fearing that his sweaty hands may efface the writing, asks his Vidushaka to hold the letter. In a play in which the mundane, divine, and magical is mixed, we have to be careful when searching for real-life descriptions. Urvashi, it is said, magically creates a page made of birch bark and writes on it. It is interesting that it is birch bark rather than palm leaf, but perhaps the reader is to imagine that her divine home was north in the mountains where we find birch trees. The other point concerns the effacing of the ink. On birch bark, one often used waterproof ink. You could soak birch bark manuscripts in water, but not always. But naturally, since this is not a manual for paleographers, but literature, there is not much point in overinterpreting details in this technical manner. However, the passage contains an interesting technical term. When the king asks the Vidushaka to take the letter from his sweaty hands, the first edition of the text by Bollensen reads, I think I have it here. I just read the translation because of constraints of time, I think. But you have the Sanskrit, hopefully big enough on the screen. So English translation of Bollensen's German translation of the Sanskrit. Friend, the sweat from my fingers is erasing the words. Keep this pledge of my beloved in your hand. The sentence seems fine, but there are other versions of this passage. One in the South Indian recension edited by Pichel, which reads, and here I just quote the passages. There we have, instead of Dharyatam ayam swahaste nikshepaha priyaya, Dharyatam idam priya swahasta likitam. Then we have the edition by Shankar Pandurang Pandit in the Bombay Sanskrit series of 1901, which is based on 8 manuscripts and 2 commentaries. There the line occurs in yet another form as Dharyatam ayam priyayaha swahastaha. Bollensen was not aware of this reading, and it would have been difficult to ascertain that there indeed is a masculine noun swahasta, which does not mean just one's own hand, but something written by one's own hand, not unlike in German, where there is the similarly elliptic formation eigenhändig, which can refer to written documents. The sense of swahasta as autograph, something written by one's own hand, is lacking in the larger Petrograd dictionary, but occurs in Monier Williams and in the smaller dictionary of Bütling. It is not easy to find unambiguous references for this sense of the word, and as the example of the Vikramurvashi shows, it is difficult to be sure because of the variation in the sources. But in fact, the meaning and form of the word could not be more secure. It occurs not only in transient ink on a leaf, but in solid metal in the famous copperplate inscription of Harsha, dated 629 AD, which says in its colophon that the nice calligraphy in Siddhamatrika script is Harsha's Svahastaha. With this in mind and returning to Kalidasa, we can see that the second, briefer version of the line is idiomatic. I mean, here, it's the third on this one. If compared with this, the other version emphasizing that the Vidushaka takes it into his own hand, so Svahaste, seems unnecessarily labored. This brief example was adduced to show 2 things. Firstly, that there cannot be any doubt that we do find technical terms like autograph in Sanskrit, terms that are surely useful for textual criticism, but secondly, that they are easily overlooked. The same applies to the whole field of pre-modern textual criticism in Sanskrit. We have a considerable body of commentarial literature which abounds in discussions of readings, but it is difficult to assemble the material and draw conclusions from it. Then there are more spectacular examples of Indian commentaries, commentators who acted as editors and sometimes gave reports of their activities. In most of the passages where commentators act as textual critics, we find not more than an explanation why or merely that a reading is to be discarded, is an upper parta, and so on. It has become common practice to assume that Indian textual criticism was not only pre-scientific, but as one imagines, medieval text transmission, a mixture of reproduction and rewriting and so forth. no awareness that insertions of other material was problematic, etc. But in this conference, we have, I think, seen some examples that this is too simple. Then we have a modern theory that not only dissect author and text, but also in the field of Indian study complicates authorship through notions of orality and so forth. We have also heard of examples for that. We can also imagine that there was no concept of textual integrity, as we see in the practice of the free reworking of Puranic material, the retelling of stories, and the like. We may also think that there was no concept of an original author, and consequently of his individual style. As an example, the story by Bühler is usually adduced. We've heard it, I think, today. I read it some days ago in the latest publication On the Field by Whitney Cox, which bears the year 2017, but is already available. I was slightly puzzled by that. And there Bühler is quoted to complain about the cooking of manuscripts. We saw this passage today. More specifically, that Sahib Ram, the court pandit of Ranbir Singh, had reconstructed the lost beginning of the Nilamata Purana. There are also other interpretations of this fact, because actually Sahib Ram was quite aware of a lot of a large body of literature, and his reconstruction is not really so bad. And if you look at modern editions of texts where half of the text is given in Sanskrit and then you have a reconstruction from Tibetan, it's not that different, actually. With all this, we tend to forget interesting evidence to the contrary. There are quite different cases of a more systematic criticism in early Sanskrit commentaries. One particularly fascinating case I found is Kshemaraja's commentary on the Shiva Stotravali of Utpaladeva. Kshemaraja is, as is well known, a sort of successor of Utpaladeva in Pratyabhinaya philosophy, just a few generations away from him. In his commentary, Kshemaraja gives an editorial report stating that after the death of the author, three editors have assembled his papers and produced from fragments and single verses the stotras which we now have. So he says that it was in disarray and there were only few stotras and the rest were muktakas and fragments, and the editors had the task, or they felt they had to construct these 20 stotras we have now. Kshemaraja makes it absolutely clear that Utpaladeva's papers contained only few stotras and the rest was just a collection of his unfinished works. And what that means is that throughout the text of his commentary, Kshemaraja finds indications that the editors were not really up to the task. He considers the sequence of verses in some stotras highly unconvincing and unworthy of Utpaladeva. He says, this is due to the grace of this editor that we find the stotra in this form. This could have never been intended by Utpaladeva, and so on. But of course, he doesn't change the sequence. He doesn't try to interfere with the text. He just notes his reservation. One shloka he is sure is spurious. He says it doesn't match the author's style. I think he says, he talks of riti. Asadrisha Shaila. So it's not worthy. It's not worthy of Utpaladeva. This must be an inserted verse. But then he says, since I'm commenting on the text as received, he leaves it in the text. I mean, he just notes his uneasiness. In other words, we find many things that one thought it necessary to explain away through invoking the medieval Indian textual mentality, which is not really up to our modern standards. We find here a notion of the author and his style, which is used in criticizing the form of the text, and we find a critical view of the history of transmission and much more. But such reflections on the underlying principles are rare, merely bits and pieces of a sort of text-critical theory. And we shouldn't entertain unrealistic expectations. It is unlikely that we will find an ancient Sanskrit manual on editing. I think that was said by Sheldon Pollock in the beginning. I fully agree. But before congratulating ourselves for the supposed high sophistication of textual criticism in Europe, that's sometimes the background of this, let us remind ourselves that even Lachmann, the 19th century editor of Latin and German works and others, who is commonly viewed as the founder of modern textual criticism, did not sufficiently explain his method. It had to be inferred from his scattered remarks. The same applies to early Indological criticism before Lachmann. So I'm talking about the Bonn School of Schlegel, all the students of Schlegel's editing, producing the first editions, mostly of Caviar works. And the same applies also to ancient or medieval text, Indian textual criticism. So I think if we could only have a large collection of all the text critical argumentations in Indian commentaries, we could start to reconstruct different schools of editing, and that would be, yes, that would actually be great fun to have that. And I think Ram Shankar Bhattacharya, if I remember the name correctly, promised something like that in an article, but he never finished it. An exception in Europe would be the long-forgotten medieval literature on an Ars Critica, a precursor to modern criticism. In India, we are aware of discussions on the correctness, Shuddhatva, of the language, but there are also discussions of passages from famous authors where the non-standard usages are justified. I think of works like the Sahitya Kantaka Udhara, which contain, in fact, a kind of higher textual criticism devoted to saving a Lectio Difficilior in known authors like Kalidasa and so forth from grammatical correction. In Europe, the developments in textual criticism came gradually, and the termini technici, derived from Greek and Latin, became part of the technical vocabulary in European languages. In Sanskrit, the terms used by commentators, like correct, samichina, inserted reading, prakriptapada, and so on, were also part of the normal vocabulary. Other terms, like swahasta for autograph, were not used so frequently. And there was, of course, no equivalent of modern European concepts like archetypes. We will see about that shortly. There were innumerable Indian editions of text during the 19th century where we sometimes find a description of sources and get some clue as to the editorial principles. But there is no protected reflection, as far as I'm aware, on the principles, no theoretical literature on textual criticism of Sanskrit. The preferred principle seems to be that of a best manuscript, a light handschrift, which is followed unless meter, content, grammar, or other arguments force the editor to adopt another reading. The method is certainly not what we expect from sophisticated textual criticism, but it is what was often practiced even by rigid adherents of stammatology in Europe. There is a revealing passage by the editor Frenkel in one of his editions, who rejects the stammatic approach favored by his colleagues from classical studies for that very reason. Those interested in textual criticism will know that the concept of a best manuscript to be followed in the course of editing is in fact the preferred method of the famous French rival of Lachmann, Bédier. But studies of the history of textual criticism have shown that the idea of a Lachmann method originated only with Bédier. It was, so to say, created and labeled when it was criticized. And finally, the opposition between the two methods is a back projection. Even Lachmann used his unclear method to identify a best manuscript with stemmatic methods, so that some critics say that in practice there was not so much difference between the two. That means Lachmann and Bédier. There's one interesting article by Schmidt on the method of Lachmann, history of misunderstanding, where he analyzes the whole conflict, which is highly interesting. But as far as theory is involved, while Bédier wanted to follow the tradition more closely, Lachmann claimed that he had invented objective editing, could reconstruct even the physical form of the archetype. But we shall not touch the complicated history of textual criticism in Europe here and just state that in India it seemed that modern and scientific textual criticism had to be imported at some point from Europe, assuming somehow that there was only one. Nowadays, the only work well known for this is Sumitra Mangesh Khatre's Indian Textual Criticism, which has remained the standard manual. Khatre was a linguist trained in Madras, then London. He subsequently worked in Pune and after retirement in Austin. His work is a summary of European textual criticism as applied to Sanskrit. Judging from quotations and the bibliography, it is based on a limited selection of works from classical studies. There is, of course, Paul Maas' small booklet, Text Critic, Textual Criticism, and a number of shorter introductions to the criticism of Latin works. One, I think, from the Encyclopedia Britannica and other things. But for Khatre, the method was well established, and he thought, as he states in the introduction, that there is nothing new in his work anyway. Understandable as it is, The practical problem with this approach is that it creates the impression of a well-established and accepted technique, not one that is highly disputed and intrinsically insecure. And one does not get the impression that wider reading is useful. The fate of Carter's book is not unlike that of the manual of Paul Maas, current in Europe. It became the standard reference work, and not many questions beyond it were asked. One absurdity with the handbook of Paul Maas is, of course, that everyone expects it to contain the method of Lachmann, but the word Lachmann doesn't appear even once in this book. As a result, the inculturation of European textual criticism for Sanskrit studies in India revolves around this book of Khatri. Recently, some attempts were made to translate the work into Sanskrit. We find a report of such a project in an article written in almost incomprehensible English, somehow underscoring the need for such a translation. It announces the translation of Khatri's work under the name Bharatiya Granta Sampadana Shastra Praveshini, and appeared in 2002. Unfortunately, I couldn't get for this occasion all the new literature and all the new Sanskrit publications on textual criticism, but I intend to do that very soon. Under present day, but I don't expect too much, because under present day political circumstances, we must expect book titles like I saw recently, Ancient Science of Editing Books, which is in Sanskrit quite okay. It's called Granta Sampadana Shastram, but I have the worst fears about the contents. So here we shall merely deal with a serious and quite sophisticated attempt to formulate the principles of European textual criticism in Sanskrit. In 1966, Venkatesh Lakshman Joshi edited a grammatical text, the Braudha Manorama with a commentary Shabdaratna, from four manuscripts and made it clear that in his opinion, the only way to produce a proper edition was by using modern methodology, which he then describes in a 100-page introduction. The text of the introduction is indebted to Khatri's book, but it starts in a traditional Shastric way by discussing the question whether this is an Apurva Shastra, a new Shastra, a new science in the bad sense of the word. A Sanskritist used to reading pre-modern texts has reason to expect that this is a rhetorical question, for the claim to novelty is at best ambiguous. But of course, one might surmise that Joshi is inspired by things like the new logic, Navya-nyaya, or by some poeticians who have a more positive view of new theories. But actually, the solution is more witty. Let us see what Joshi says in his introduction in the passage under the heading Kim idam apurvam shastram. Is this a new shastra? I think I have it here. Sorry, probably too small. And I'm going to read only the translation. Which one is the most authoritative of the four manuscripts? We have to, for determining the Mula Granta. The readings in which of these can be adopted as the Mula Granta. In which manuscripts do we find more scribal blunders? Where are more additional passages? Is the relationship between the branches of all available manuscripts one, or is it divided? These and many other topics have to be thought about by discerning important from unimportant, like the Hansa extracting the milk cleverly and by using one's own intelligence. End of quote. Joshi answers the question by quoting the Cambridge textual critic Hausmann from this famous article, saying that, I just quote, a man who possesses common sense and the use of reason must not expect to learn from treatises or lectures on textual criticism anything that he could not with leisure and industry find out for himself. The textual critic engaged upon his business is not at all like Newton investigating the motions of the planets. He is much more like a dog hunting for fleas. If a dog hunted for fleas on mathematical principles, he would never catch a flea except by accident. End of quote. Unfortunately, that's not given in Sanskrit as well. That's quoted in English. Joshi gives only a summary in Sanskrit stating that this means that it is not a new science, and a quotation from Khatri's introduction is adduced to the same effect. Textual criticism is above all an application of common sense, whereas, and I quote, canons of criticism should be used with due recognition of their limited validity. So that's quotation of Khatri. To elaborate his point, Joshi states that the Shastra can show the way but does not allow predictions. One cannot say that since we studied the text, we can expect that there will be certain errors also in other manuscripts. So he says, Anyeshwabi hastalikiteshu etair eva doshair bhavyam, or that these errors will be everywhere, etair doshair sarvatra bhavyam. One always has to examine individually the evidence. For Joshi, the method to be followed for arriving at the original text, which he also calls Mula Granta Sampadana Shastra, is a contemporary one. He says, Imam cha adhunika shastriya padatim ashritya prajina bharatiya grantanam avashyam sampadanam kartavyam bhavati. So by resorting to a modern shastriya, scientific method, we can also edit old Indian texts. As he makes clear, this method is not an undue novelty, apurvatva. It is, on the contrary, applicable to old texts, since they all suffer from the same type of alterations as introduction of variants, loss or augmentation of passages, and so forth. Joshi then lists some of the normal errors with appropriate Sanskrit terms. Loss of text is trutihi. We have confusion of letters, vyatyasa, insertions, prakshipta parta, dvilekanam, dittography, adhikyam, addition, and so forth. A rather elaborate listing is made of 16 possible errors due to the similarity. Sorry, that is probably too small, but I'm not going to discuss that in detail anyway. So that's a listing of errors due to the similarity of aksharas, to which phenomenon much space is devoted. Not all terminological regulations are simple or consistent, because it was the task of Joshi to coin Sanskrit terms for all the terms he wanted to integrate into his method. For instance, among the types of errors, we find a specific definition of lupti. The otherwise unattested formation, lupa and so on, lupti, means, of course, loss of text and is presumably used to avoid wrong association with a grammatical term lopa, which occurs in the text all the time, I assume, because it's a vyakarana text. Now, lupti is defined in one passage as a certain kind of truti caused by eye skip due to similar letters. But we also have other types called grasa, so devouring of text, and so forth. Sometimes the presentation is unsystematic, as the list of errors caused by similarity of sounds or letters, that's this one, shows. The first entries describe more or less mechanical confusions. It starts, for instance, with Lekana sadrishya chanita bhranti mulako varna vyatyasa. So a confusion of letters being caused by an error resulting from a similarity of writing. But the last entry really describes the emendation of a gap by a scribe or a modern editor. I just translate the last one. In the place of letters and words omitted through the inadvertence of previous scribes, one places new ones through one's own reasoning. So actually that is a filling in of a text by a learned scribe. So quite different. So in his presentation there are some inconsistencies, but I think it's quite an interesting attempt to Sanskritize textual criticism. Under the heading Sambandha Vimarsha, we find a discussion of the stemmatic relationship between the manuscripts. First, Joshi checks whether all his manuscripts are derived from the oldest, which is not the case. Then, under the heading Sulabhataraha Partaha Svikaryaha, is the easier reading to be adopted, he deals with the selection of readings according to their intrinsic merit. Read the translation. Does not determining the original text mean to adopt the best reading? Then which one is the easy and correct reading, and which one is the incorrect reading that is difficult to understand? Such deliberation is not valid. Rather, it is in many places appropriate to assume that the more difficult of two given readings is the original. And then he continues, since experience shows that at the time of copying, the editor, Sampadaka, the reader or scribe may often indicate and settle on an easier reading for simplifying. That's just a guess. He says lapana, and I don't know what he means by lapana. Dissolving difficulties? I don't know. And just provisionally, for simplifying the text. Therefore, regarding the question which is the original reading intended by the author, we have to disregard what is better, worse, easier, or more difficult, but follow the scientific method of healing the variation. According to this reasoning, the reading accepted as the original can sometimes be the incorrect one. If this is not a too strong translation for Asamichina. End of quote. The reader will at this point wonder whether Joshi is still a pragmatic textual critic. This statement could also come from a hardcore stomatologist who will adhere to his objective method mechanically, even if the resulting text is asamichina. Classical philologists would then, of course, resort to the next step in editing, which is emendatio. I would prefer to look at the rest of the transmission, also to stemmatically inferior branches for solutions, than to insist on my own conjectures. Given these preliminaries, it was to be expected that the production of a stemma of the text would demand detailed attention. All stages in the construction of a stemma are richly illustrated by Joshi with examples. I must remind you that this is a text of 100 pages. I mean, the introduction is 100 pages. So this is the first attempt at a stemma. And here we find that Joshi is using his own terms. The word mulaleka would mean original writing, autograph, but it can also mean the writing of the mula text. It's not quite clear because we have a mula text and a commentary. That is, the text that is the basis of the commentary. And in fact, the word doesn't occur in older literature as far as I could check with all the search engines we now have at our disposal. We only find the word mula lekaka, and that probably means the writer of the mula text. Here our term svahasta would have been a good option. The second entry, adyavriti pustakam, means archetype, and that's also a neologism. It occurs nowhere else. Joshi is also inconsistent, for later he calls it mula lekadya pustakam. We can only speculate on why Joshi prefers to coin new terms instead of using older ones. If the method is so commonsensical, then there was no need to produce a new terminology and set the method apart. The autograph could have been called Svahasta, and the first copy could have been an Adyadarsha Pustaka, for instance, which would have been easy to understand and more in line with classical usage. Joshi's introduction is 100 pages, so what follows is a rather long disquisition on the relationship between the four manuscripts. It is obvious from shared omissions and other errors that three form a group against one. The inquiry into the provenance of the manuscripts, they are kept in the India office and stem from Colebrook's manuscript collection, leads to an explanation of their close relationship. They were apparently commissioned by Colebrook when he was in Varanasi. If we now add speculations about the author's pupils and the supposed manuscript copies, we arrive at the following stemma. It is called Vangshavriksha, and incorporates much information on how Joshi reconstructs the transmission of the text. Such a stemma is always impressive, especially if it's backed up with all kinds of reconstructive efforts. For instance, the main division into branches, which he calls Shaka, is assumed to be marked by the copies of two disciples. Then we have sub-branches, Upashaka, that can already be dated more exactly, because we know when Colebrook was active in Varanasi. A practice in textual critic will, of course, ask in more than one sense for the bottom line. How are the actual manuscripts, which are marked by consonants, related? Here's a technique of using vowels for the archetypes, sub-archetypes, and so on, and consonants for the actual manuscripts available. So the three Colebrook manuscripts are, of course, in one branch against the single manuscript Ga in another branch. But here, unlike in the simplified version of the stemma given earlier in the book, we have two additions. There is an assumed upashaka, sub-recension, cha, and a dotted line from Ga to one of the Colebrook manuscripts, indicating contamination. Every editor knows that these tricks of the trade. The dots mean that it's not possible to keep the two branches neatly separate. There is contamination between the two manuscripts from differing branches. The manuscript Cha, by the way, doesn't really enter into stemmatic considerations later in the book. And then I forgot to print that. He has a verse describing the method, and I just read the Sanskrit and explain it. It's given with his stemma, which is printed in the beginning of his book. It runs urdva mulam adhak shakam vangsha vriksham vidur buddhaha leka pustaka shak kopa pra shakadi ativistritam. So a vangsha vriksha, a stemma, is one that has his roots up and his branches down. So that's the main definition, and it's made vistritam. So it's differentiated by leka, meaning mula leka, autograph, pustaka, meaning probably first epigraph or manuscripts, and then Shaka, and then he has a strange compound, Shaka, Upa, Prashaka. So Shaka, Upa Shaka, and Prashaka, because he has different levels of sub-recensions here. So this is his, Karika on textual criticism in Sanskrit. I found that very funny. Before going any further, let us first see how Joshi interprets the evidence and how he proposes to proceed in editing by discussing the question, which manuscript has more authority? I read the translation again. Among our manuscripts, manuscript Ga is historically the oldest. Furthermore, manuscript Ga was for the most part written by a student. Based on this, it is appropriate and necessary to accept that it has most authority, among all manuscripts. Therefore, manuscript Ga is our basis in every respect in case of incorrect readings and where a scribe's negligence has produced an error. But we must not forget that scribes learn it in the matter and scholars may show their own knowledge and erudition while writing, even in the middle of the work, as occasion arises. Therefore, in cases of insertions or simpler readings, etc., where we find variants in different manuscripts, we have to be discerning when it comes to accepting the authority of learned scribes. End of quote. How many minutes?
Minus two? Yes, it was something like that, but your predecessor has given some more time. Okay. So let's say three.
I'll try. So this is, in a sense, the small print of textual criticism. According to strict stemmatic rules, once we diagnose the intervention of learned scribes, we have to discard the stemma if we take Paul Maas seriously. Of course, no one does, because then this objective stemmatic editing would hardly find any application and no stemma would ever be produced. One usually tones down the claim to mechanical objectivity, talks of a serviceable stemmatic relationship, that's a quotation from West, that may still be useful unless contamination is too pervading. As a reaction, the perhaps not so well-known school of contamination critique tries to acknowledge the matter more directly and dispenses with stemmatical relationships altogether. Now, Joshi's stemma, since it has two branches, doesn't help much, since there are no stemmatical grounds on which we would select one or the other branch. The only case where a stemmatic argument for selecting a reading could at all come into play would be if one of the group of three shares a reading with Ga. According to textual criticism in non-contaminated recensions, we would then have to accept the reading more or less mechanically. But as every editor knows, this applies only to an ideal world best realized in artificial transmissions and never in India, I think. So I jump a little ahead. An alternative would have been to avoid a stemma altogether and follow the methods developed for contaminated recensions. It is my impression that some Indian editors' pragmatism is not too far from this, but out of context, even this statement is dangerous. For saying this, I have been charged by Michael Witzel with defending uncritical editions, which was not my intention. But what I would like to emphasize in concluding, and here I differ from Witzel, is that stemmatology is only of limited value for many transmissions of Indian texts, and therefore his rule that a critical edition is one that has a stemma which shuts out the adherence of Pascali's school is too narrow. And it is also deceptive, for an edition with a stemma can still be one of three things. First, an actual application of stemmatology. That means that the editor is selecting readings with the help of a stemma. Second, the determination of a best manuscript with stemmatic means, there are many examples for this, which is then followed without further consideration of alternative readings, in the worst case, of course. And third, a highly pragmatic edition in which the stemma is not actually used, but is merely a convenient graphical version of the reconstruction of the history of transmission, and of course a visual sign that this is a critical edition. We also have to acknowledge the fact that a stemma with two branches is of not much use in editing unless we determine which branch is better, which then would already be a step out of stemmatology. The dilemma with a bipartite stemma, as the one we've seen today, is that we have a choice of two equal readings and have to use those subjective criteria that were rejected by Lachmann in order to promise objective editing. If we determine the better branch, we are simply using the better manuscript method, and the whole stemmatic exercise is reduced to a display of conformity to supposed academic expectations. For all these reasons, we find that in the field of classics, for instance, Pascali and Frenkel worked without stemmatics. In Sanskrit editing, we can adduce the examples of Coulson in his edition of the Malati Madhava, and Srinivasan in his Sankhya Tattva Kaumudi. It is unfortunate that the multiplicity of methods and the controversies surrounding their application have never reached Sanskrit criticism in India. But Pascali's fundamental work on the topic has to be read in complicated Italian, and Srinivasan's description of his method is in equally impenetrable German. If these two works have not even reached the rest of Europe, we cannot expect them to reach modern Indian textual criticism. Thank you.